Special Sauce is brought to you by Soyve. Unlock the awesome with marinades like Very Very Teriyaki and Hoisin Garlic.
Welcome to Special Sauce, SiriusXM's podcast about food and life. Every week on Special Sauce, we talk to some of the leading lights of American culture, food folks and non-food folks alike.
Almost the best way to motivate me is to tell me we're not fulfilling our potential.
I wrote a blog post for Serious Eats called, "Why Do the Shake Shack French Fries Have to Suck?"
You wrote that? I didn't know that was you. I wouldn't be here today if I knew that was you.
This week, Danny Meyer is back with us to talk about many other aspects of his life. He's the CEO and founder of the Union Square Hospitality Group. Meyer is also chairman of the board of the hamburger stand Shake Shack, the now publicly traded company with more than 60 locations. Danny is also the author of the best-selling business book cum memoir Setting the Table, The Transforming Power of Hospitality in Business. He has been married to the lovely and talented Audrey Meyer for 28 years, very shortly. A warm welcome to Audrey Meyer's husband and the father of four, Danny Meyer. Danny, I was struck in the introduction to your book, mostly because it spoke to me very directly. And you said that I was born to go into business for myself, and I was destined to find a business that would allow me to share with others my enthusiasm for things I find pleasurable. And that's basically how I've spent my entire work life. And maybe it's one of the things that has made us get along so well and bonded us, is because I think you genuinely have that, and it goes beyond the restaurants. You know, it's like you want to turn people on to the things that matter to you and explain to them why they matter.
I think that's true, and so many things in my life inspire me. Part of what you do better than anyone I know, and it's something that we always try to do, is if you like something, that's only the start. There's two other things that are really important to you, and I believe to me as well, which is if I like something, I want to share that with other people. But even before I share it with other people, I want to go do my homework and go figure out who I think does that thing the best and
Absolutely.
Really try to learn from them.
Yeah.
And so you can take something as simple as, or as seemingly simple as spaghetti a la carbonara. It makes me happy. I've always loved it. I get a big smile just saying it. And if I go to Rome with one of our chefs, like Nick Anderer from Maialino, we may taste 16 versions of spaghetti a la carbonara, because it's fun to do that. But it's not just an intellectual pursuit. It's a hedonistic pursuit to say, of these 16, which one made us the happiest? Why? And then come home here and try to get as close to that as we can before we then share that with other
people.
It's
true. It's why I spent a year of my life eating 1,000 slices of pizza for my pizza book.
Mm-hmm.
It was for exactly that reason, so I could synthesize it, come back and tell people why they should care about great pizza and the people that make it. And, you know, that is something that we share. And, you know, I've done that my whole life. This woman came up to me when I was giving a talk on food at Fairway, and she said, you know, I went to Grinnell with you and when you were bringing all the music to campus. And she said, you know, you're doing the exact same thing in food that you did with music. You're telling us what stuff is good and why we should care about it.
And do you know that I was jazz DJ at Trinity College?
Really?
Doing the exact same thing.
It's true. So this obviously gets us to Shake Shack. People think, oh, is Danny's way to riches, you know, and fame. And it's like, I know that it wasn't that.
Well, everything that I had ever done, including Shake Shack, was highly episodic and just intuitive. I never set about with a five-year plan for anything. As a matter of fact, Union Square Cafe was 10 years old by the time Gramercy Tavern, restaurant number 2, opened.
Right.
In fact, We didn't open our second Shake Shack for 5 years after it was born. So every single time a restaurant opened, it was because it seemed like a good idea at the time. And some exogenous opportunity arose that just felt right. So Tom Colicchio and I had met in Aspen when he was picked as a Food and Wine best new chef when he was in Mondrian. And it was the same year that Michael Romano, who was my chef and partner at Union Square Cafe, had earned that same acclaim. And we just hung out cooking together, and I really liked Tom, and then he got involved with Share Our Strength. And then when Mondrian went out of business, he called me on the phone and he said, I want to do a restaurant with you. And I had promised myself I would never open a second restaurant because I didn't want to end up bankrupt like my father had. And I always associated his bankruptcies with expansion. Little did I know that it wasn't really expansion. It was lack of building a strong team around him. But I couldn't resist any more than, you know, if Sandy Koufax called you and said, I'd like to pitch on your team.
Find a place for my on my roster.
So we did Gramercy Tavern, but that wasn't part of my plan, and nor was it part of my plan to have the next two restaurants be 11 Madison Park and Tabla. But there was this incredible building overlooking a desolate park called Madison Square Park, and it just seemed like a great idea to try to wash, rinse, and repeat the experience of helping to renew Union Square Park, but to do it with Madison Square Park. And at that point in my career...
Which wasn't a fun place to hang out.
Well, it was somewhere between forgettable and unfun.
Yeah.
But nobody hung out there whatsoever. You drove by, it didn't even know what it was. And so at this point, the motivator for me was... almost always to prove that the previous one had not been a fluke, to prove to myself that I was not an imposter. So I kind of felt like Union Square Cafe was just luck. You know, we're really not that great. I don't know why we won the James Beard Award for best service in the country, because I don't think it is. And that was before I had really defined for myself that it wasn't service they were lauding, it was hospitality. They just didn't know it. But... at that point, I would say my big motivator was I only want to open places that can get 3 stars from the New York Times. And all 4 of those restaurants did. Union Square Cafe, Gramercy Tavern, ultimately 11 Madison did, not right off the bat. And Tabla did get right off the bat. And then the experience of opening 2 restaurants within 4 weeks of each other, 11 Madison Park and Tabla, almost crushed me. We had doubled the size of our organization overnight. I didn't have any kind of really infrastructure to speak of. I was working out of the basement of Gramercy Tavern. Every time the toilet flushed upstairs, the pipes over my head in my office would whoosh, you know, I could tell a lot about what was going on upstairs. And then I got a call one day from my cousin, James Polsky, who had opened a jazz club, Jazz Standard, as well as a restaurant upstairs called 27 Standard. Not cut out to be a restaurant guy at all, but huge jazz fanatic. And he said, I'm not enjoying the business. He had gotten 2 stars from Ruth Reichel for his restaurant upstairs, but it really was kind of a forgettable restaurant. And he said, I want to sell it. Everyone who's making me offers wants it so they can turn the Jazz Standard into a nightclub. And he said, my dream is to keep the Jazz Standard. Will you take over the restaurant? And I kept saying, no, I'm never doing another restaurant again. This has just killed me, opening these 2 restaurants at once. And finally, and he kept this up for about 1.5 years, I finally said, if I ever open another restaurant, it's just going to be a joint. And almost that same week, I got a call from a guy I knew from St. Louis, Rocco Landisman, who at the time was running Jew Jamson Theaters. And he said, I know you're a big St. Louis Cardinal fan. I got a group of friends from the theater business who are barbecue fanatics, and we hear you like barbecue. Would you come over? We'll take in a Cardinal game. We'll you know, drink some beer, and we want you to taste the barbecue from a guy we know who has won more grand championships at Memphis in May than anybody, a guy named Mike Mills.
Our friend.
Our pal. And I said, yeah, okay, but I'm not opening a restaurant. And they said, no, you will. Wait till you try his food. We want you to open a barbecue restaurant in New York. And unwillingly went over. We had a great time. Mike's ribs had been frozen and shipped. We had his beans. And damn it, if the thawed ribs were not amazing.
Yeah.
That then led to meeting Mike in Murfreesboro, going to Memphis in
Murfreesboro, Illinois.
Murfreesboro, Illinois.
Southern Illinois.
And I couldn't get the smile off my face. That then led to Mike coming to New York City. And I looked him in the eye and I said, you know, here's the problem. You can't have barbecue in New York City. They won't let you. Do you know what it would take to build a chimney, you know, in a vertical city? It's not the same thing as having this thing outside the back. And I said, we would only want to do this. And by the time I'm negotiating, I can see that I'm getting closer to actually doing it. I said, we would only want to do it if our ribs could be as good as when you won your award. Can you teach us how to do that? And he said, well, the best time I ever made those ribs was the year I got the blue smoke. And I went, what? What are you talking about? And he said, well, that was the year. You know what happens when you've just cooked that meat just perfectly and the fibers and the tendons, they open up, and that's when you hit it with the sauce. And if you get it at just the right time, a blue smoke comes up right out of the meat.
Wow, it's like something from the heavens.
And I said, we're doing it, and that's the name of the restaurant right then and there.
Wow.
And then that kind of set me off for the first time in my career, not with the aspiration to open a three-star restaurant, but to open a joint. And it felt like that would go really well with jazz. And so we did a deal with my cousin. And now for the first time in my career, we had a restaurant that was a very different kind of restaurant. And the next thing that happened not long thereafter was that the Museum of Modern Art called us because they were going to be closing for the purpose of completely renovating the museum. And they invited us to compete to create a fine dining restaurant, two visitor cafes, and a cafeteria for the staff of the museum. So now we started to, and we won it, obviously. The day the museum opened in the fall of 2004, we opened Cafe 2 on the second floor of MoMA. Zero practice. We served something like 4,000 people that day. We had never done anything outside of the Big Apple Barbecue Block Party where that many people had shown up. But now all of a sudden, in addition to three-star New York Times restaurants, we've got a jazz club, a barbecue joint, and a museum cafe. And we started to see that there were people on our team who wanted to stretch their wings and learn how to do things beyond just fine dining.
Mm-hmm.
And then finally, and then this leads to Shake Shack, because we had created the Madison Square Park Conservancy for the purpose of raising funds to beautify the park, create programming, make it safe. The vision to turn Madison Square Park into a public sculpture park was being realized. And because we didn't have enough of the people on the team to do the art ourselves, we hired the Public Art Fund, which is it's a public-private organization, fantastic organization here in the city. And one of the first artists that they brought to us was an artist from Thailand whose piece of art was called I Love Taxi. And he had two huge taxi cabs on stilts, and he wanted to have a working hot dog cart go with his piece of art. He was making a political statement that everyone in the world has either been able to afford to be driven in a taxi cab or had to be the guy driving it. Everyone else in the world has either been able to afford to buy a hot dog or had to be the guy selling
it. It's about common humanity.
It was. And they needed someone to operate the hot dog cart. And we said, well, we'll be glad to do that. We'll cook the hot dogs up in our private dining room at 11 Madison Park, wheel them over to our cart. And I decided that I was starting to get fascinated with this whole concept of enlightened hospitality. And did hospitality only apply to fine dining, or do people crave it wherever they go? And could it work with something as mundane as a hot dog cart? And I had to convince our team. They thought I was crazy. Like, why are we wasting our time? Silly thing? This was the summer of 2001, the summer of Gary Condit, right, leading up to 9/11.
Right.
And so we did the hot dog cart to go with this piece of art, and we would have lines of 60, 70 people a day. The experiment was, let's take care of our team first. So we employed four out-of-season co-checkers who, instead of having to wait till October, they were the guys running our hot dog cart. We said, let's do Chicago-style hot dogs, not only because I love them, and I thought that would be a fun thing to give New York as a gift, which, unbelievably, no one was doing in
right.
New York. But the eight classic toppings would give us a chance to employ hospitality because we could remember, oh, Ed's the guy that likes everything except neon relish, and Susie's the woman who likes everything except mustard.
So you could apply your hospitality
with something
rules.
Like this.
Yeah.
And of course, we lost a bunch of money because there's a reason hot dog carts have one and not four employees. But it turned people's heads. And then the next summer, when the city was depressed because we were in the post 9/11 world, that piece of art was gone. But the community begged us to bring back the hot dog cart. So we did it for the second summer, 2002. We did it for a third summer, 2003. And finally, in 2004, we said, why don't we turn this into a permanent kiosk? And so I had read this book by Billy Shore, the founder of Share Our Strength, called The Cathedral Within. And he talks about this amazing concept called community wealth, meaning that when you want to raise up a community, historically that's been done either through government or through philanthropy, but why not use capitalism to do it? And so we raised money philanthropically to build a kiosk. We gave the kiosk to the park, so the park would become our landlord. We would own the business. We had absolutely no aspirations that this thing that we called Shake Shack
right.
would do anything other than be a magnet to bring people to a park, to keep it safe, to spend money, to be happy. A huge percentage of that money, which would go right back into the park to build community wealth and hopefully, you know, bring more people to the park. Well, it certainly did that. And, you know, to this day, I think Madison Square Park Conservancy earns well over $600,000 a year from Shake Shack. It certainly brings people to the park. It has certainly built lots and lots of community wealth. Just ask all the landlords around the neighborhood. But we also got a nice business out of it, which I never, ever imagined.
Right.
And it wasn't until our fifth year that we opened a second Shake Shack.
Yeah. You know that Serious Eats was actually birthed at the line at Shake Shack because I was bunking at a friend's office coming up with the idea for Serious Eats. And we, of course, had no conference room. So the line at Shake Shack became our conference room.
Well, I love hearing that story. You know, I've heard stories about Twitter being born over a snowball fight at Shake Shack early on. It's you know, as Paul Simon said, it helps to be born at the right time.
Yeah, it's crazy. And we used to have literally it was like, so what would Serious Eats be? And my chief technology officer at the time was David Karp, who went on to be the founder of Tumblr. And we would just be waiting online, and the line was not just part of the experience, which it is, but it was the incubator. So, you know, now that Shake Shack has become a publicly traded company, you know, you and I have talked about this. You know, I sold Serious Eats last year, and I started to feel like people think that I'm just in it for the money. And you've probably gotten some of the same blowback. And when you hear that story of the birth of Shake Shack, it's so clear that that's not true. I guess it's that not very many people know that story.
Well, it doesn't really matter to me. You know, I will just be as candid as I can, which is that the day after Shake Shack had its IPO, it was a hard thing to, you know, sit down with my kids who were reading blogs and, you know, whatever, talking about the net worth of their father. you know, which is fine. Market cap is what a market cap is, but who had any idea whether I was locked up, could sell the stock or not? But, you know, I sat down with our kids and I said, you know, this is a nice thing. And I'll tell you what's really nice is that 100% of the employees at Shake Shack, 100% of them had the opportunity, were given the opportunity to buy stock at its opening price. And they were not locked up. 100% of our managers were given stock options. And so things happened for people that I never in a million years could have done myself, like people paying off their college loans 8 years before they thought they would, and having that cloud lifted over their head so they could go about their lives and do, you know, do great things for their families. I'm really proud of that. But I told our kids, I said, guess what? None of our values changed whatsoever. So regardless of whatever number you see, we're still not ordering water from the minibar when we stay in a hotel. And I'm still not buying first class tickets for our family, whether you like it or not. And you're still waiting in line when you go to Shake Shack. And I said, last time I checked, well before Shake Shack, we've been fortunate enough. I said, when was the last time we were not able to take a Christmas vacation that we wanted to take? Our lives are good, and you know, if one day we are able to be more generous with other people, this would be a wonderful thing, and I'm really proud of that.
Yeah. And it's funny how, as I'm listening to the stories of the birth of all of your businesses, that they are part hard work, part focus, and absolute serendipity. You know, when I think about the Big Apple barbecue block party, right? I remember a couple of things about that. One, you asked me to be on the steering committee, so we were in the Jazz Standard during the day discussing, well, who should we get, and could we get a few thousand people that would come and eat barbecue?
Could we get a few hundred people?
Could we get
a
few?
I don't think we were talking in thousands.
Yeah, and it was just like, how do we do this? How can we, you know, and we never imagined in a million years that it would become this thing where 100,000 people would show up. And we were like, you know, well, what pitmasters do we want, you know? And it was just a thing that we all felt passionate about, because at the time, New York was not a barbecue city. And it was like, how great would it be, getting back to turning people on to the things that we get so much pleasure from, if we could bring these pitmasters to New York? And now it's become this big thing. And the pitmasters, to me, I get such a huge kick when I go to it every year, are like celebrities. And the idea that pitmasters can become celebrities, that is really what America is all about in many ways, you know, because these are people of modest means, often modest education, and they have become something where when I tell you, oh, you want to meet the pitmaster, they're like, it's like I'm telling them I can introduce them to Bono,
right,
you know, of U2. And yet that started from that little meeting that we just thought, wouldn't it be fun if?
Yeah, and that started, and this gets back to, you know, what motivates us in the first place. So the pursuit of barbecue basically was, New York does not have historically a barbecue tradition. I would argue it should be on any barbecue lover's map. If what you really want to do is crisscross this country and eat good barbecue, I think you make a big mistake to not put New York on your map today. But when we opened, there was nothing. There was
absolutely
Virgil's, and then there was a place in Long Island City called Stick to Your
Stick
Ribs.
Stick to Your Ribs, started by a former Twiggy hairdresser.
Okay. Oh, that's right. That's right.
A Brit.
So, and that was pretty good. But there, you know, there really wasn't much in the way of authentic pit barbecue here. And we were stung, because when Blue Smoke opened, without question, our product was incredibly inconsistent, because in addition to all the things we had learned, we did not know how to manage a 17-story smoker with a 17-story flue. And we didn't understand the engineering that rather than bathing the meat gently for hours and hours and hours, the draw on a 17-story flue, which didn't exist in any of the barbecue destinations we went to, was almost acting like a blow dryer.
Right.
On the meat. The thing that stung, though, more than anything, it didn't sting me to hear that, you know, I've gone to Blue Smoke 5 times and I've had everything from ethereal ribs to, you know, pork jerky, depending
right.
on the time. That was a fact. What stung was, oh, and by the way, who the hell does Danny Meyer think he is anyway, opening a barbecue joint? Because he doesn't even know anything. He's
right.
just opening this for the purpose of,
sure.
you know, putting one over us. That stung. And that motivated us in the first place to reach out to many of the pitmasters who had lovingly schooled us as we had crisscrossed the country doing 60,000 miles of research. North Carolina, East North Carolina, West North Carolina, South Carolina.
Sure.
All the places, Tennessee, Mississippi, Arkansas even, Opie's, Texas, which is to this day my favorite. And so we said, why don't we invite these guys for a block party in New York? Let them, first of it was going to be a pitmaster dinner series, the way we had worked with winemakers at
right.
Union Square Cafe.
Right.
We said, that's too small a crowd. Let's open the block. Let's invite 5 of them. We got 4 or 5 our first year. We'll have some music to go with it. And let's have Blue Smoke out on the street with them side by side so that the critics can come see we're not that much worse than these guys.
That's funny.
And then secondly, let's get guys like Ed Levine and Jeff Steingarten and I forget who else we had. That Stephen Shaw was there, and I think Lolas came the first
year.
Yeah,
Lolas, Eric Eli, my friend.
Bud Trillin came. Let's get all the people who we think know the most about barbecue, some of whom had justifiably criticized Blue Smoke. But let's give them the microphone, because partly we have a consistency problem. Partly we have an education problem, because New York doesn't really understand barbecue. Am I supposed to pick that thing up? Why is the meat pink? You know, what do they know?
Yes.
And let's be sponsors of rising the tide of barbecue rather than being the boat that they're all shooting at.
Yeah. You've always been inspired by
criticism.
Constructive criticism.
It's true.
Look, we're still friends. We're still sitting across the table, and I wrote a blog post for Serious Eats called "Why Do the Shake Shack French Fries Have to Suck?"
You wrote that? I didn't know that was you. I wouldn't be here today if I knew that was you.
And
no,
yet,
we are. Yeah, almost the best way to motivate me is to tell me we're not fulfilling our potential, because who needs us if we're not fulfilling our potential? We want to be held to a higher standard. We really do. And sometimes it's something I didn't see but should have. Sometimes it's something I saw but didn't have the courage to change or didn't have the wherewithal.
Right.
And so it's really, really helpful when you have intelligent criticism that says, you guys, you know you could be doing better. What's going on
yeah.
here? Now, with respect to the French fries, we were in denial for the longest time because Shake Shack's motto is stand for something good. And we basically believe that we want to do things that others wouldn't or couldn't do. And so we said, obviously, fresh is always better than frozen. And obviously, it's a bigger challenge to make fresh French fries than frozen French fries. Let's take it on. Frozen French fries have chemicals in them. And you know what? Your blog post, as well as many that followed it, ultimately got us out of our denial, is that, guess what? In the world of French fries, fresh is not better.
No, it's true. I mean, I have this, and you went back. You sent me a T-shirt that said, "We listened." And then it turned out that the millions of Shake Shack fans wanted the frozen French fries. So you took one of your 6 rules and you applied them to the Shake Shack French fries.
Which is absolutely right. But Part of what happened, though, is when we brought back frozen fries, we found a frozen fry that tasted even better than the original one, that was non-GMO and no chemicals.
Wow.
And the reason we discovered that is that when we brought Shake Shack to London, the laws of Great Britain prohibited. They actually sent back an entire shipment of our original French fries because they had GMOs.
Wow.
And so we had to find a company
that made.
And then once we did that, they ended up actually tasting better in London than they had in New York. And we said, let's get that company.
That's funny. So now it's time for the special sauce all-you-can-answer buffet. You know, we don't have a Jeopardy clock and we don't have a theme song. But so, you know, you can take your time if you'd like. What's in your desert island fridge? Three things.
Well, it's not all going to be in my fridge. I'm going to have some really good olive oil, and I won't keep that in the fridge. I will have milk and coffee. If I only get three things.
Those will sustain you?
No, they won't sustain me, but I don't intend to live a life where I can only have three things.
Yeah, you could catch some fish on the desert island and cook it in the olive oil. So that'll work. We'll make it work. So who's at your last supper, no family allowed? Could be anybody.
Yeah, how many people can I have?
Five.
Five. I want to have musicians that make me feel good. And I think you said they don't have to be alive, right?
No.
So I'd like to have John Lennon.
Okay.
I don't know if these people are going to get along.
Doesn't matter.
But I'm going to make them perform for me afterwards.
And wait, but it's your job in life to get people to get along. You'll figure it out.
I'll know how to make that happen. Yeah. So I'm going to want John Lennon, and I'm going to want James Taylor, and I'm going to want Carole King, Donald Fagen, and Paul Simon.
Wow. That's fascinating. No jazz musicians. Like, I thought you were going to go to, like, Charlie Parker or Thelonious Monk. But
Thelonious Monk. Oh, boy. That when I put Round Midnight on, I just swoon.
Okay. All right, I'm going to allow you to add Thelonious Monk.
Okay, that would be pretty cool.
So what are you eating?
We're having spaghetti alla carbonara.
Okay.
Followed by bistecca alla fiorentina with fagioli, white beans just drowned in amazing black peppery olive oil. And we are drinking boatloads of great Tuscan wine.
Oh, wait, can you add one more guest? Can I come?
Yeah. It wouldn't be the same without you.
So what's your guilty pleasure?
I don't really feel guilty, but I am always, always happy with a sausage and mushroom pizza. And I think
you should
I
never feel guilty. You
I probably
feel
know
proud.
As much about sausage and mushroom pizza as you know about pizza. I mean, everywhere I go, I'm looking for my favorite sausage and mushroom pizza.
That's a religious experience. That's a piety.
It is.
So what do you cook when there's nothing in the house to eat?
Pasta, because there's always pasta, and there's always something in the refrigerator that I can make taste good with pasta.
So what do you put on the pasta?
Well, at a minimum, olive oil, pecorino cheese, and a ton of black pepper. That always makes me happy. Cacio e pepe. And then I don't really care. I mean, there's going to be some greens that are a half a day beyond when I want them for salad. They're going to go in the pasta.
I love this.
There's going to be vegetables. There's going to be salami. There's going to be
whatever's
a hunk of mozzarella that's a half a day beyond what I wanted for a caprese salad. That's going to go in the pasta.
All right. So one person that you can have, that you can sit down and have a one-on-one lunch with that you think would be the most fascinating time.
Well, this is a strange one because I've had the opportunity to serve this person several times in our restaurants, but and we've talked, but I've never had a real long conversation. That would be Stephen Sondheim.
Really?
I think that he is a genius, not just in terms of his music, but in terms of his, and not just in terms of his lyrics either, but his plays, which I rarely like when they first come out, like the music of a lot of the people who I mentioned earlier, when you first heard their new album, you didn't necessarily like it, but the same piece of art changes over time as I change over time. I think that's a fascinating thing.
Yes, I agree.
If you return to a film that you haven't seen for 25 years, or you return to a play, or you return to a piece of music. And Sondheim's plays have a just remarkable sense of kind of understanding mortality, understanding relationships. And I cry almost every time I go to one of his plays.
It's the definition of great art that it changes.
As you change.
As you change. So anyway, thank you so much for sharing your special sauce with us, Danny Meyer. It has been such a pleasure. This has really been one of the highlights for me.
Obviously, I want to say thank you to you for inspiring so many people in our industry to do even better.
Oh, well, thank you for that.
You have done that.
Thank you for that. And go to Shake Shacks all over the world. Have yourself a burger in Bahrain or the UK. Go to his many wonderful restaurants. The Jazz Club is really one of the great jazz clubs, by the way, in the world. The Jazz Standard, the sight lines, the food, the music, everything is perfect, but it's so much in keeping with what we've talked about. So anyway, Danny Meyer, thank you again, and we'll see you next time, Serious Eaters.